I guess the place to begin is why these three and why tell the story the way that you did, which is going back and forth sort of in a parallel universe three different ways.
Yeah, I always wanted to write the story of the women of the 60s. It's my generation, and we lived an amazing story. And every time I thought about that, I thought about these three women, not just their songs. Their songs tell the story from Carole King's Will You Love Me Tomorrow through, you know, Carly's fabulous feminist You're So Vain and beyond into the 70s and 80s. But also their lives told the story. I mean, we all kind of were aware of how they were living their lives, and they felt like us. You know, they obviously were much more famous and much more talented, but they went through a lot of the changes that we went through. I did decide to tell it in that three kind of layer cake style, the way books like The Group and Loose Change and Superior Women were told, you know, a group of women, you know, coming of age, that kind of thing.
Well, of course, lots of different things affected each individual, but it seemed that they did have some common threads of their early lives really affecting the work that they eventually did, the songs that they wrote, the relationships that they became involved in and then involved out of and then into the next group. So It starts with Carole King, who was writing all these great songs when she was almost a teenage mother.
Yes, she was a teenager, and then she was a teenage mother. She was a teenage mother, a teenage wife, mother, and hit maker, all before she was 20 years old. Wrote the number one hit for the Shirelles, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, which really was, in a way, a groundbreaking song for women, and wrote Up in the Roof for the Drifters, and did all of that before she was 20 years old.
And she was doing that with her husband at the time, Jerry Goffin, and you never really know how these songs come about. Of course, in those days, with Carole and Jerry being involved with the so-called Brill Building factory of hit makers, right. It was interesting how that song was done and how it came about. She left a note on the refrigerator for him. Why don't you tell that
right.
story?
Sure. Well, first of all, they got married when she was pregnant. I mean, that's what you did then. You got pregnant. My God, you had to get married. She was madly in love with him. I don't know that he wanted to get married so early, but he did. And they were really a unit, writing song after bad song, as he puts it, you know, in their little apartment with their baby, you know, really pressed. And he really understood her. He was a quiet, kind of moody, monosyllabic guy, but he really understood her. She wrote this gorgeous, gorgeous melody that sort of told the whole story in the melody, and he sort of intuited their life from her point of view. You know, a young woman who takes a risk on having sex, and you know, a song like that hadn't been written for the radio before. I mean, it was too risky, and so she left to play mahjong with her mother. You know, middle class Jewish girl in Brooklyn, and said, "Donnie," meaning Donnie Kirshner, "needs a song tomorrow for the Shirelles. Please write." And he listened to this gorgeous melody, which was different than anything she'd ever written before, and the words just came tumbling out. And he put himself in the place of a woman, basically Carole, and told that story.
I think most people might have thought she wrote the lyrics and he wrote the the music to something like that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting. At the same time, just I guess maybe a little bit ahead of that, Joni Mitchell was working to establish herself as a musician, and she gave up a daughter for adoption because she was pregnant as a teenager as well, but she struck out on her own. But that really affected the rest of her life.
Absolutely. She was 21 when she had her baby. Her parents didn't know about it. She grew up in a very, very prim area, a proper area of Canada. Her parents would have been absolutely unheard of for her to have been a single mother. And so she went to Toronto, hid the fact of her pregnancy from her parents, but not from the rest of the world. She went out to play in coffee houses when she was beginning to show. And this is a girl who had no money. She had no money. I mean, she had so little money that her rooming housemate brought her apples. He was afraid, you know, she was going to keel over. She sat in her room alone, starting to write songs. And to me, that is so much more courageous than anything Bob Dylan did, with no ill respect to the wonderful Bob Dylan, but that was such a rite of passage. And then she did indeed give the baby up for adoption, and it haunted her for a long time.
We're talking with Sheila Weller, the author of the book on the New York Times bestseller list, as well as others of her books. Sheila Weller of Girls Like Us, out on Atria Books. And the third component, Carly Simon, who grew up in quite different circumstances from Joni Mitchell and Carole King.
Yes. Carly's father was Richard Simon, the co-founder of Simon & Schuster, intellectual, cultured, musical home, sophisticated home. Her mother was a very sophisticated, almost coquettish woman who was also a civil rights activist. They had the creme de la creme of, the intellectual world in their living room. And Carol and Joni had very middle-class homes where there was middle-class morality. In the Simon home, the parents were having affairs. They were very ahead of their time. So she had a very different upbringing. It was kind of the cultural upper crust, but complicated. She didn't feel her father loved her. Her mother was having an affair, and it was crushing to her. So and she was beset with phobias. Very interesting, complicated young woman.
And in each case, their upbringing and those experiences really almost drove them into different kinds of relationships that they really couldn't help themselves about. It was almost like they were continually making the same kind of mistake, almost.
Or the same kind of taking risks and kind of pushing it all forward. You know, one thing they did have in common, they all had very strong mothers, very strong. Each of the mothers was, as different as the mothers were, very, very strong. And I think they got a lot of that strength from their moms. One of the reasons I called it the journey of a generation is, in a way, this generation was the first of women who decided to be as adventurous as guys were. I mean, guys could always go to war. They could always go sowing their wild oats and doing crazy things before they settled down. Women were never really allowed to do that or never supposed to do that. And between the birth control pill, the kind of psychedelic revolution, so many of the changes that these women, we all lived through and helped affect, women became as adventurous as men. And so they did take risks, and they kind of lived large lives and sang about them.
Yet they were also really a little bit ahead of the curve for the women's movement, because they were doing this in the early to mid-60s, mm-hmm. and it wasn't until after they established themselves and had their first recording hits that the women's movement really became to the forefront.
Right. Well, I think they were the women's movement. I think the women's movement came from both as a corrective and a continuation of all the changes that they were annotating, that they were describing, that we all went through. Joni has this arc of song from From Mountains to Cactus Tree, where she's basically writing a primer for young women before the women's movement, young women who wanted to be bohemians in cities, live with, taking lovers as they wished, but with dignity, but with self-respect. This was totally new. There were no rules for doing this. Girls weren't supposed to do this, but they were starting to. And a song like Chelsea Morning talks about waking up in your apartment that's all yours. And just there's so much, love and delight in living that way. Both sides now is here she is. Maybe her heart's been broken a couple of times, but she's still going to go through, her choice. She's glad she didn't marry the guy in college. And Cactus Tree really tells, other girls how she did it. With my heart that's full and hollow like a cactus tree, I will love him when I see him. That's a whole new way for girls to live, because there was no culture that said, now, guys aren't supposed to treat you this way. Shame on you, guys. It didn't exist. So everything they did, all the songs they wrote, led to the place where the women's movement kind of bubbled up, and then in the early 70s was kind of sold to the country by a group of media-minded feminists in New York, and Carly was very much a part of that group. She looked like them. She lived among them. Her friends were them. She went to a Seven Sisters college like they did, and she wrote with Jake Brackman, "That's the Way I Always Heard It Should Be," which was a ballad in which a woman is saying, "I don't know that I want to get married. You're going to cage me on a shelf." That was always a guy's feeling before. So feminism came from the journey.
And paths did cross, though, as time moved on. In reading the book, James Taylor seems to be one of the vortexes for all three at one time or another. Of course, Carly Simon was married to him. Carole King, probably best known for collaborating occasionally and performing occasionally, and James taking her song You've Got a Friend and making a hit out of it. And Joni Mitchell out in Laurel Canyon sort of wandering in and out on that. Why don't you talk a little bit about some of the history that they made on their own and with others, because Crosby, Stills, Nash came together because of Joni Mitchell.
Yes. It was a community in Laurel Canyon and New York. I mean, yes, Crosby, Stills, and Nash first did that wonderful, you know, celestial harmony in Joni's kitchen. As, you know, Graham Nash chimed in over Crosby and Stills, and there was this amazing harmony, and Joni was kind of one of the boys, and she and Graham became lovers, and he was madly in love with her. Interestingly, Joni, who really was, you know, is an artiste, an artist. I mean, she strikes out. She believes in kind of the difficulty of life. She left Graham, you know, because he kind of loved her too much. It was a little too easy. She went to Crete, and she got involved with Carrie, the mean old daddy. That was part of it.
At the same time, they were getting into different situations. Carole really looked at upon by the people she was working with as a veteran and as an idol, because she had such great success. Mm-hmm. And then she found herself working with these younger musicians. Yes. In California, in Laurel Canyon.
Yes, she was, you know, she was the Brill Building pro. You know, in the days before singer-songwriters, she and Jerry and their friends wrote the songs and gave them to other groups to sing. She comes out in 1967 was a time when you could become younger as you got older, you know. Suddenly she was living this, like, a little too mature life. She was had this complicated husband. She had two kids, you know. She was already so responsible and so successful. And she moved with her daughters to Laurel Canyon, let her hair go out, started wearing what we called granny dresses, and was ensconced with a group of musicians. Some did come from New York, but they were younger than she. She was sort of the only mom, the only single mom. And she fell into a different kind of life, which was much freer and more creative. And, you know, she became sort of hipper, you know. It was really a family of friends. It was really a deep, deep community. And James was part of that. And she wrote the songs of Tapestry about that community of friends.
Joni Mitchell, in the meantime, was still trying to make a name for herself. But it was not until 1969 when she never got to Woodstock. She wanted to go, but she had an appearance booked at a TV show in New York and wrote the song about Woodstock that Crosby, Stills, and Nash made famous, not being there, but after the boys got back to her.
Well, first of all, she did make a name for herself. I mean, she had a name for herself as a magnificent songwriter, even before she recorded her songs. Both Sides Now, Circle Game, and others were being recorded by eminences in the folk field, and then she started recording her own versions of them and her own songs. But indeed, with Woodstock, it was just getting very dangerous. I mean, Woodstock was becoming this massive event with, you know, no one knew if they'd safely get in and out. So she was stayed in David Geffen's apartment and watched it on TV while her guys were performing, were kind of airlifted in. But as David Crosby says, she felt it more keenly and understood the essence of Woodstock more than anyone who was performing there. She saw it on TV. She thought of her farmer grandparents. She was very proud of Max Yasger, who gave up his farm for the event, and thought of her farmer grandparents, and understood the significance of all these hundreds of thousands of people coming together peacefully, spontaneously, and making a statement. And she wrote that gorgeous song.
Yes, Joni had her reputation preceding her before she actually recorded, really just as Carole did, because it wasn't until Tapestry, of course, that she was really known as a performer for getting her own work out.
Yes, and she and James were two of the early singer-songwriters. So was Joni. The whole, you know, they kind of ushered it in. They did, or Laura Nero did.
And then we have Carly Simon, who came from a wealthy upbringing, who worked odd jobs and did whatever she could to make her own way, which was kind of the twist on all of this.
Yes, absolutely. You know, as her sister Lucy said, there was more deprivation than luxury. I mean, they were culturally very, you know, high up there. But, you know, she had her father died, and she was certainly raised in great style and all of that. They had two houses. But she did these odd jobs, and it was an era when you weren't supposed to be rich. You know, one of the reasons she couldn't get a contract early was people like Albert Golden looked at her and said, "You're too rich. You're a rich girl." You know,
and he so was, of course, favoring Bob Dylan and yeah. Peter, Paul, and Mary, and yeah. so-called struggling artists.
Struggling artists, yeah. You know, but she was struggling a lot emotionally. You know, so she sent songs out and to Dionne Warwick and many others. They didn't record them. She worked at the Bitter End or the Bottom Line. She worked in the letters department at Newsweek. When her hit album came out, so did a jingle she wrote for a savings bank in central Massachusetts. I mean, she was really, you know, schlepping her songs around and trying to make it.
Yet she was also very famous for being having a huge anxiety attacks mm-hmm. when she would perform, and she went around various ways to try and overcome that.
Yes, she did. The first, when her first album came out, she had to do a show, and she didn't want to. The day of the debut, you know, the first performance, her manager was kind of chaperone, road manager, were worried that she'd never get on the stage. Ultimately, I mean, there was a slippery microphone, so she concentrated on that and forgot her stage fright. That taught her a lesson. She subsequently did things like wore shoes that were too tight, so she would think about her feet hurting instead of the, you know, her stage fright before performing for President Clinton. Right after Smokey Robinson, she had every member of her band spank her, so she'd go on stage in pain, you know, and not think about her stage fright. And once she did kind of break down and had the whole audience come up and do sort of like a, you know, be on stage with her to get her through it.
I think you said they were massaging her back
massaging
and feet.
Yes.
Yet, at the same time, she formed great friendships with many people, one of whom was Jackie Kennedy Onassis,
yes.
who, of course, at that time was living in New York, working as an editor at a publishing house.
Exactly, at Doubleday, yes, and friends with Mia Farrow, too. Carly is a great friend of women. You know, she had sisters. She's sister-oriented. The other two didn't have sisters, weren't sisters. Carly was and is a terrific friend, and Jackie loved her because, as their mutual friend Joe Armstrong says, Carly was madcap. Carly was spontaneous. Carly just says what she feels, and her heart is on her sleeve, and she's mischievous and funny. And Jackie apparently had been like that before she became First Lady, and then she became the nation's widow, and you know, and then she was this untouchable figure. And you know, people said that being around Carly brought out the side of her that used to be. And actually, she did funny, practical jokes with Carly. She was just really very funny.
We now have the two early starters, Joni Mitchell and Carole King, receiving all these honors over the last several years, induction into halls of fame and being recognized for their career of work, and Carly Simon seeming to find happiness and stability. They're all grandmothers now, mm-hmm. which is hard for some people to believe.
They're all grandmothers, and they're still working. Carly just put out a new album of original songs, and Carol has a DVD that she has out from her living room tour, and Tapestry's been reissued with outtakes that no one's heard before, and Joni put out an original album, Shine. She did every single musical part herself that came out in the fall. They're still very relevant, and they're special. I mean, when you think of, you know, having written their lives and looking back on their lives, they went through a lot. They went through a lot of pain, but they never sunk to self-pity or self-destructiveness. And I think there's a lesson in that for a lot of young women who are too obvious to even name, who are in music and acting today. You know, here were really strong women.
Is that what you hope people to take from the book when they read it? Because, again, you're going through three parallel stories that go in cycles and the paths cross. But ultimately, what do you hope people will take from this story?
That's part of it. Yeah, lives well lived. You know, rich, big lives. I mean, adventurous lives. I mean, I was surprised when some reviewers said, but they led unhappy lives and there was so much heartache. There was, but I don't think any of them would say I would have liked to have led less of a life. They did really wonderfully risky things. Carol moved to Idaho. She married two mountain men in a row, and I'm not exaggerating when I said they're mountain men. You know, and she's from Brooklyn. That's a risk, you know. One of them died of a drug overdose. I don't know that she would have not done that, though. Carly had 10 years with James Taylor, who she was madly in love with. He was a heroin or methadone addict through almost the entire time, but they had two beautiful children and still had a wonderful time together. Joni gave up her baby for adoption, went through a lot of pain about it, settled it in her mind, and then reunited with her. I don't know if they would make different choices, but I think we look at their lives and say these were lives full of great risk and passion, and they lived them with tremendous aplomb.
We're talking with Sheila Weller, the author of the book Girls Like Us, published by Atria Books. One of the interesting things about this is the fact that only one of the subjects spent any time with you at all. That would be Carly Simon. The others did not speak with you, or you couldn't have access to them, so you were able to get to people who knew them and who grew up with them, I guess. What were the challenges of not having access the way you did to Carly Simon?
Well, oddly enough, journalists understand that sometimes it's better to not have access. I mean, at the end, I would have wanted to have checked things with everybody, but you don't want to do an authorized biography. You don't want to start out and have a celebrity think, you know, you're theirs, and you're telling their story according to the way they want it told. So I wanted the freedom. I didn't want any doors closed. I didn't want people to say, oh, I'll check with Carol or Joni, and I realize I can't talk to you. And you skirt that. You know, I mean, basically, people did want to talk. I would have ultimately wanted at the end to be able to come to them and ask them questions. And I attempted with Joni. With Carol, I didn't think I would be welcome, so I didn't make that attempt. But as long as you feel you know how, you know, you work really hard to get access to all the significant people that you can find in their lives, sometimes you get a better story that way.
And in looking down the sourcing that you did, because it's a very well-sourced book, you document where you got your information from. One of the things that I look at when I look at a
sure.
book like this is I think I would have to say that judging by what I saw, the books that were written were the books that were the most accurate and reflective of what was going on during those times, as opposed to some of the books, as in most of rock and roll, where it's a little bit questionable.
You mean the books that
you list in the bibliography,
right.
And having interviewed Timothy White, actually just before he passed away, after he did his James Taylor book, he was on the air with me, and he had complete access, of course, to James, because they were good friends.
You know, that's an example. He did have complete access. I think the book had such respect for his... For James Taylor, I think that was a good example of a book where...
too close.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
Another interesting thing that I saw was, this was in one of the footnotes, the Laura Nero incident at the Monterey
yes.
Pop Festival. She thought she was being booed off the stage, which sort of affected her.
It did. And it's kind of like a story from De Maupassant, when Lou Adler and Michelle Phillips listened to the enhanced version of her performance. Only decades later, when they didn't have enhanced sound digitalizing until then, they realized it wasn't a boo, and they tried to get it in touch with her, and by the time and she died, so she wasn't able to know that they weren't booing her.
Laura lived in this listening area, and it was a few years ago that she passed away. Unfortunately, I believe it was ovarian cancer.
Laura was an amazing artist. She was extraordinary.
She, in that same group of people, actually, they were all contemporaries, and her illness and other situations kept her closer to home.
Yeah,
I think she might have,
because I loved Laura, and she was the only one. She was the only female singer songwriter that Joni respected and considered a peer when Joni was just starting out.
The book is Girls Like Us. Carole King, Joni Mitchell, Carly Simon, and The Journey of a Generation. Sheila Weller is the author. It's published by Atria Books. Thank you very much for spending so much time with us today to talk about it. Congratulations on it.
Thank you.
And we'll look forward to the next book.
Good. Thanks.